We'll proceed with the second case of the morning, which is Ryan DeKeyser versus Wahuka. When everybody gets sorted out, we'll proceed. Okay, Mr. Snodgrass.
May it please the court. My name is Joe Snodgrass, and I represent 484 foundry workers who have brought claims under the Fair Labor Standards Act and corresponding Wisconsin state law, seeking time for decontamination activities performed at the foundry. The workers seek reversal of two summary judgment opinions. The summary judgment rulings were handed down after the district court instructed the attorneys not to submit expert evidence such as industrial hygiene, exposure, toxicity, etc. The district court was intending to try to find out what categories of evidence would be relevant to the determination of compensability. The employees contended that five categories of evidence mandated compensability without any further expert evidence. As an alternative, they said that the five categories of evidence with expert evidence would certainly do it. The five categories of evidence were as follows. The employees were trained to decontaminate. The employees were instructed to decontaminate. The employees had to sign acknowledgement forms acknowledging that they would be exposed to metal dusts, unknown and hazardous metal dusts, lead dust, silica dust, and also these forms had showering instructions on them.
Now, employees have different job assignments, obviously. Who is employed there in the same category?
Everybody signed the same acknowledgement forms.
Okay, I don't know who's not in that under that. There are some people who were, I don't want to call them white collar, but who were not engaged in the foundry work and that.
Office workers are not part of the
opt-in. So this is strictly the people who work in the foundry.
Correct.
Now there's a swipe card division. Some, I would say most, swipe after they get in their work area.
Correct.
And a few, because of, I think, extra hazardous stuff, they swipe, before they enter it, or at least they dress after they enter it. I'm not quite clear on that distinction.
Right. There is donning activities before swipe. There is doffing activities post-swipe. Those were the subject of expert measurements and testimony, but again,
and then there are some who don and doff within the swipe time.
Some donning and doffing activities, yes, but the decontamination activities, Judge, no. The showering, decontamination, clothes changing, no.
Okay, what do they do? In the hazardous area, I'm going to try to describe them as a little bit different. In the most hazardous area, they just leave the clothing in that area and someone then washes it?
No. They come into the locker room.
Over some kind of coveralls, I assume.
No. They have to wear natural fibers because of the burn hazard in a lot of the areas. So they will come into the locker room. The locker room is segregated into clean and dirty areas. They will disrobe the contaminated clothing and now they're off the clock. They've swiped. They'll disrobe. They'll put the dirty clothes into commercial laundry bins. They will shower. They will proceed to the clean side, get the clean side clothes, leave the facility.
Now, some are, that's not a requirement. Some are allowed to go home if they want to and do all that stuff at home, I guess.
Let's be clear. The word recommendation has come up, and I wanted to talk about that. And the appellee has focused on required by the employer. The actual regulation says required by the rules of the employer. And the rules of the employer, in writing, in the safety, in the instructions, are shower and change. And rule, the dictionary definition of rule is interesting because the appellee cited the dictionary definition of required, but the regulation, 790.8C, says required by rules, not required by the employer, required by rules. The rules are unambiguous. Shower, change clothes. They're in MSDS sheets. Shower, change clothes, leave your contaminated clothing.
But counsel, I mean, I guess they don't simply say shower and change clothes, nor do they say you must or you're mandated to or you're required to. don't they most or the documents say that you should or it's recommended or in order to preserve your health or to benefit your health, you should shower, we recommend that you shower?
No, the MSDS sheets generally don't contain the words recommended. There's plain instructions on what to do. And just as the acknowledgement...
You said the evidence, what did you say, sheets? I missed that.
Material safety data sheet. And we just summarized them in our appellate brief, but in the summary judgment record, we set out many categories of MSDS sheets with the strict instructions. And these instructions are clear.
So under that rationale, for every employer that uses any sort of chemical compounds with MSDS sheets has a set of whether we call them recommendations or tasks or activities associated with them, your position is that in all those cases, any actions in accordance with those MSDS recommendations are compensable under the FLSA?
Maybe. If the employer gives the MSDS sheets as here and says, follow these instructions, yes, that's compensable. If the employer says in the hazard communication standard, you know what, this MSDS sheet should be ignored, or more importantly, if the employer finds an MSDS to be overstated, he should remove it and put one in that's accurate, because they have that right. It's the employer's choice what they give to the employees. There's MSDS vendors.
This is Judge Caney again. But you have a multitude of what appear to be voluntary requirements, suggestions, ideas, some requirements. Is there any one specific thing that you shall shower and doff and don?
Well, probably the most direct document is the acknowledgement form wherein it says, if you work in a dusty area, shower. I'm paraphrasing. It's in the it's one of the acknowledgement forms is attached to a declaration at the end of the appellant's appendix for Thomas Cooper or Carlos Lance. There's also acknowledgement forms that say, I might be exposed to lead dust. Usually it's undetectable, but it could be higher. There's also acknowledgement forms that say, I will be exposed to unknown metals that may be hazardous. And the MSDS...
Is there any penalty imposed on employers who fail to heed the recommendation or command?
Which recommendations and command, Your Honor?
Well, I guess that's the issue. Are there recommendations or commands to which the penalty is attached for not donning and doffing clothes after being exposed to dust?
Yes, penalties can attach. And this brings us to one of the issues that was really unprecedented in the underlying court's order. The court held that because there was not a specific regulation applicable to foundries promulgated by OSHA, there could be no FLSA coverage. The court will note when it reads the two underlying opinions from the district court, the court didn't cite any case law. There's no court that's ever said that, no legislative history that says OSHA defines what the FLSA. In fact, they don't even cover the same universes of employees. But putting that aside, OSHA always has, for those people, those workers it does cover, OSHA always has a minimum floor. It's the general duty clause that basically says that employees should be able to work in an area free of any recognized hazards. That's always the bare minimum floor. And that was one of the errors that the district court made. There's a case cited in our brief, In re Kelly Springfield Tire, for example, where OSHA was considering promulgating an ergonomics health standard, a whole set of regulations on ergonomic health standards. One of the employees, well, this was in the rulemaking pipeline, one of the employees complained to OSHA and said, I'm having to change tires and I'm getting hurt. And the Seventh Circuit said, it doesn't matter that this standard hasn't been passed yet. There's always the floor. You're always subject to the general duty clause. So if you have ergonomic hazards, you're always subject to that. That's always a floor.
Well, there's not much question that this foundry is, what's the dust called? What is it?
Foundry dust?
Pardon me?
The foundry dust?
No, whatever that, the toxic.
There's silica, lead, there's all kinds of chemicals in there.
That's one most discussed. There's no question there's an exposure here.
Correct.
And that this is working in the foundry. It's also I don't think it's undisputed that OSHA is pretty tough on regulating these foundries in general, and they scrutinize them. Maybe you would think it should be more, but it's not like they ignore it or anything else. So there is a certain level. And I know that you say that, and maybe it's true, the U.S. Steel case doesn't really apply because the union was involved. But I know when Judge Posner wrote that opinion, he did have a paragraph there where he assessed what the economic impact is of that. And that's why the union, in that case, said, we're going to wash up on our own because we prefer higher pay for the 40 hours that we are actually in the hazard area. And we have a similar situation here, and that is, how much is this going to cost? Is it going to be 15 minutes at each end of the shift, or what?
Well, in the Steiner case, after the lead dust was on the workers, lead dust just isn't the same in this case, I believe the district court came to a 20-minute matter, and that was upheld. But you're talking in that range, yes.
Okay, but see, that's an extended day or a shortened day in the foundry. I'm not sure which, and we're not really analyzing that, but that is a factor that at least the union and U.S. Steel they bargained over. Now, we don't have a union here. I understand that. And I understand that foundries are not everybody's desire to work there. They're a tough place to work.
Correct.
And I think there's a lot of turnover, and inevitably, if somebody can find a better job. But we're looking at it strictly from how this particular operation was run and to what extent it's really absolutely necessary versus voluntary or recommendation. And we're at the recommendation stage, as best we can tell, as opposed to a mandate.
Well,
a rule or a law.
Well, and that's where the breadth of the FLSA really attaches, and the care that an employer has to put into its hazard communication program. If there truly is no reasonable health and safety need for workers to be engaging in decontamination activities, the employer is compelled to say so, and the employees can go home. But the employer can't do what this employer is doing, is instructing them to do it and then saying, after they say, well, we really didn't mean it. That's not permissible under the FLSA suffer and permit standard. And on Sandifer,
with regard to the MSDS sheets, the employer is, as I understand it, legally obligated to provide employees with certain notice to provide them with the sheet so they can be informed as to what they're dealing with and the range of possibilities. But there is no legal requirement for the employer to require that the employees follow all of the activities outlined in the MSDS sheets. Isn't that correct?
That's correct, but the employees need to know what to do. And so if you give the employees the MSDS sheets and no further information, you can't complain after the fact, as the employer is here, that they followed the MSDS sheets warnings. If the MSDS sheets are overstated, the employer's got an obligation to say so. The employer can even substitute out an MSDS sheet it finds overstated. It can supply its own. It can get another one from a third party. It just can't give MSDS sheets out that say do X, and then when the employees do X, say, I'm not going to pay it. That's not the way it's supposed to work. And that's what happened here.
Well, what makes sense about wash up and doffing and donning of when somebody shows up at work? Is this always going to have to be compensated? And then next question is to follow that one is it paid at the same rate? Obviously, when you're out working in that hazardous area versus the locker room and the shower, do they get a lower wage? Would that be anticipated if they're just changing clothes?
Yeah, if a employer really wants to do this correctly, yes, they address this up front with the at-will employee, and yes, employers can have piece rate work and lower weight for unproductive work, and there is even different tiers of compensation like that for unproductive work versus piece rate work in this system here.
Okay,
so certainly an employer can control that.
But if then you have the 40-hour issue, or is the locker room doffing, donning, is that overtime?
Well, we only can get it if it is overtime. And remember, the overtime rule.
If you got 40. Are there three shifts or one shift, or does that depend on the economy?
There's multiple facilities, so primarily one.
Okay, so you're either, I don't know whether it's set 40 hours work, and maybe if the shift shuts down at the end of the day, that wouldn't be as much of a problem as there's not a continuing shift. I don't know enough about, I don't want to know very much more, I think. So that is the only thing I'm looking at is what is, I kind of look at it from an economic standpoint as well. I mean, these people have to, everybody's got to make money, and a worker wants to be paid.
I see.
I'm interrupting a little bit of your time. I may give you an extra minute or so at the end. I just want to finish that.
Well, you know, the economic issue in Sandifer, I think, weighs in favor of compensation here because, keep in mind, Judge Posner in that case said if the union hadn't negotiated that this would have been compensable time. And he said that the employees are trying to get double paid twice for the same time. This ruling kind of sets up now a situation where the non-union employer doesn't have to pay for it, but the unionized employers have to negotiate over it. So economically, we're giving a competitive advantage to ThyssenKrupp, which was never, I mean, the FLSA is supposed to create uniform standards. There's even a, we said it's not supposed to create a competitive disadvantage. And that's what the facts of Sandifer said. And Judge Posner's last paragraph where he's saying, you know, you're killing the golden goose and these employees are opposed to each other, that has to only apply in terms of a union, because otherwise, if we're talking about at-will employees, everybody negotiates what they can for themselves. There's always an inherent conflict when you have individually negotiated workplaces as opposed to collectively negotiated workplaces.
If your time is up, I did ask some questions, but I'll give you a little extra time at the end.
Thank you.
Mr. Benson?
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Counsel. My name is Paul Benson, and I represent the defendant appellee, Waupaca Foundry. Three things have been lost, I think, in the briefing and the argument to this point on this appeal. One is that this is an FLSA wage and hour case. It's not a toxic tort case. What the plaintiffs want from my client is for us to pay them copious amounts of back pay in the form of overtime at time and a half for work that they claim that they have performed at Waupaca that they haven't been paid for. Secondly, the general rule is clear. Clothes changing and showering are normally not considered work under the FLSA. Normally, that is considered a preliminary or postliminary activity under the Portal to Portal Act. And third and finally, it is undisputed that numerous Waupaca employees choose of their own volition to don, doff, and shower at home and elsewhere. There's no dispute that workers come to work with their clothing on. There is no dispute that workers leave work without showering and with their dirty clothes on. That is their choice. And what's most important, and this gets to one of the questions the court asked, there is no employment consequence associated with that. In other words, there is no policy of the employer that requires that they don, doff, and shower at Waupaca. They can choose to do so as an employer convenience, but it is not required in anything. It is significant to note that tomorrow, Waupaca could, if it chose to do so, it's not going to, but it could, turn off the water to the showers in every one of its plants and board up the locker rooms. If we did that, we would not be in violation of any law, of any employer practice, or of any industry practice. One of the documents that we provided to the court in our supplemental appendix was the declaration of Fred Koloff. He is the Environmental Health and Safety Director at the American Foundry Society, and he says, in no uncertain terms, it is not the policy of the American Foundry Society to recommend that foundries require their employees to don, doff, and shower at work. And most importantly, there is not a single foundry in the country that does this. And believe me, if there was one, I guarantee you that my opponent, Mr. Snodgrass, would have found it, because he found amicus briefs from the 1950s in the Steiner case. He found records from the district court below in cases decided in the 1940s. If there was a foundry in this country that paid their employees for donning, doffing, and showering on site, it would be in this record, and it is nowhere to be found.
I assume there are foundries, some unionized, many not. Is that fair?
That is true. That is true. And WAPACA, as we've already established, is not a union foundry. We are a foundry, a non-union foundry, I should say. We have plants in three different states, and each of those plants has three shifts, first shift, second shift, and third shift, and the donning and doffing and showering activities take place on all of those different shifts.
That's one of the questions I was asking before. So they are three-shift outfits, so it's a continuing operation.
Yes, it is.
So obviously, if you have, donning, doffing as, I don't know what you would call it, that there's going to have to be some significant overlap, I would assume. You have some people donning and others doffing in the locker room, I guess, and then they would be paid, under his view, that they'd each be being paid at some level. But there has to be a 40-hour segment for each of the others, so that you would be adding hours. In order to do that, you would have to have a 40 plus.
It's overtime. Yeah. There's absolutely no question that if the plaintiffs were to prevail in this case, for every minute that an employee is adjudged to be eligible for time and compensation under the FLSA for donning, doffing, and showering, that time and compensation will be a time and a half. Because otherwise, if it falls within the 40-hour work week, it's not considered overtime. The only way it becomes something that's compensable is if it's at time and a half.
But if it would fall within the 40 hours, you'd have to shut down the line for a few minutes, I guess.
That probably would be true, Your Honor. That probably would be true. The reality is
Mr. Benson, I'm sorry not to interrupt. Can you address Mr. Snodgrass's comments regarding the MSDS sheets and their relevance to his arguments?
Certainly. Actually, two things. I'd like to address MSDSs and these acknowledgement forms. These acknowledgement forms, there was a question asked about about office employees. Office employees who never set foot on the production floor goes through the same HAZCOM training at the WAPACA foundries as the production employees do, and they sign off on the same acknowledgement forms. None of those acknowledgement forms say anything about requiring any employee, office or production, to don, doff, and shower on site. With regard to the MSDSs, this all goes back to the HAZCOM standard and the hazard communication standard that OSHA has promulgated. As we argued in our brief and as the district court judge, Judge Griesbach, found, HAZCOM is a communication standard. It is not a conduct standard. So what HAZCOM does is it tells the employer, if you have this variety of chemicals at your plant, it's necessary for you to communicate accurate information about those chemicals to your employees. You have to make available MSDS sheets that relate to those types of chemicals. But you are not required to implement every single recommendation that is found in an MSDS sheet. And as Judge Griesbach, who went through the painstaking task of going through all of those MSDS sheets, if you read his opinion, he tells you what those MSDS sheets say. When they talk about showering and clothes changing, they're talking about acute exposure scenarios. In other words, someone's out on the plant and something happens and there's an acute situation where you are overexposed to a particular chemical. In those types of situations, WAPACA has, out on the foundry floor, showering facilities. But that's not the showering we're talking about for two reasons. Number one, it's just not. And number two, to the extent showering is occurring out on the production floor, that's after swipe in and before swipe out, so it would already be paid for.
Well, that one is an emergency situation, I would assume, such as that one would be out on the floor, and the other is just routine practice for any employee who works on the floor.
Your Honor, that is absolutely 100% correct. And, in fact, in the district court's ruling, Judge Griesbach said as much. He said that those MSDSs are talking about emergency showering. The hook that the plaintiffs have tried to use throughout this case is they have used a section of our HAZCOM training that talks about cupola dust. And I'll tell you, if I had a nickel for every time they have thrown that document in front of the court and my client, I would be a millionaire. That cupola dust is a very unique thing. When you think about a foundry operation and you think about the pour that occurs with the molten metal and the sparks flying, the big thing that does the pouring is called the cupola. And that will generate dust at various points in time, in particular during the time that it's cleaned. There are only certain people that are exposed to cupola dust. They are in the melt department and the melt maintenance department. That totals, just so you know, out of the 480 or so opt-ins, that's 52 people.
Do they address after swipe? After the swipe? When they swipe in? When the swipe, as I understand it, is what you call it, when they start the clock.
Correct.
And I wondered if that 52, do they don and dress after they swipe, or do you know?
Well, and this is part of it. I'm sorry, I'm going to have to answer your question that it depends, because some of the PPE that is donned and doffed is donned and doffed after swipe. Some of it is before swipe. As a general rule, unless the employee shows up with their uniform already on, they will typically don their uniform on before they swipe in and go out on the production floor, which is one of the reasons we make the argument that there can be absolutely no rational reason that pre-swipe donning could ever be compensable. The only justification the plaintiffs have for this compensation under the FLSA is health and safety. Well, if you donning your, it doesn't matter where you don your uniform, if you do so before you go on the production floor, the donning of the uniform has nothing to do with health and safety. The only thing in issue would be the post-shift doffing and showering, which obviously only occurs after you've been on the production floor and you're dirty. But again, the evidence is undisputed that a number of our employees leave their work without donning, or excuse me, without doffing their uniform or without showering, because that is a choice. Now, this cupola, I want to get back to the cupola dust, because you will see that that is the one document that they cite in their brief. It's in their appendix at page A360. And if you look at it, it only applies in the context of cupola dust, number one, and it doesn't require showering. It simply recommends that the employees follow good personal hygiene and shower at the end of their shift. That is a recommendation, because how could we discipline somebody for not following it? You can't discipline an employee for their decision not to follow a recommendation. You can only discipline an employee if they fail to follow a requirement or a rule of the employer. And the district court here found very clearly, number one, there is no legal requirement. There isn't. It isn't found in OSHA. It isn't found in any of the statutes. The district court also very clearly found there is no employer requirement. And then the last thing the district court found was that the nature of the work at these foundries did not require it either.
And, Mr. Benson, getting to that point, that is, whether or not the donning and doffing and showering requirement is necessary for the performance of the employee's duties, which is, I think, the statement in Keller when this court cited the Dunlop case. Why isn't that an issue that a jury can decide? I mean, juries and district courts deal with issues like that all the time, don't they? And so, well, I guess that's my question. Why isn't that particularly within the purview of the jury? Why do we have to, or why in this case did the trial court feel that it needed to rely upon, basically make a negative inference, given OSHA's absence of requirements in that area, to grant summary judgment? I mean, why not send this to a jury?
Because the court recognized that post-Steiner, the nature of the work requirement has evolved into a functionality requirement only. Here's what I mean by that. In Steiner and in the Portal to Portal Act, the FLSA, that all predates the creation of OSHA. OSHA was subsequently created and is given the very specific task of determining whether or not the nature of the work requires certain conduct. If it does, what OSHA will do is they will issue a rule or a regulation, or they will issue a citation. And I found it interesting in their reply brief that they talked about the citation under the general duty clause that was issued in the diacetyl context. As someone who has litigated the diacetyl issue for the last 10 years, I found it very intriguing because that's exactly what the general duty clause is for. It's not some sort of affirmative mandate upon which you can hook a legal requirement. You use an OSHA inspector uses the general duty clause when he or she goes into a facility and sees a situation and goes, you know what, that's a problem. That's a health and safety problem. And even though there's no rule that I can cite them on, there's no regulation that I can cite them on, or any industry practice I can cite them on, I can use the general duty clause in that instance and cite them for that situation, which is exactly what happened in the case of diacetyl. It is significant to note that there is affirmative statements in our record from our environmental health and safety director who has indicated WAPACA has never been cited under the general duty clause for any sort of violation related to the donning, doffing, and showering not being required at WAPACA. And if you think about it, using the general duty clause as a weapon like the plaintiffs would use is really a problem, because now employers are supposed to guess whether or not they have a situation that could become the subject of a general duty clause citation and have to try to predict that and modify their conduct accordingly. That's not a standard.
But I guess, Mr. Benson, I guess my question goes is more in lines of where OSHA, where there is a lack of an OSHA requirement in a particular area, does that then, as a matter of law, preclude a jury from determining that a particular activity is necessary for the performance of an employee's duties under the FLSA?
In the context of the nature of the work standard, and, Your Honor, I see my time has expired. May I answer your question? In the context of the nature of the work standard, it does. And the reason for that is that when you have a situation like that, where it's unclear whether or not the nature of the work requires it one way or the other, that's the exact situation that OSHA was created for. The nature of the work now, the kind of issue that Judge Griesbach agreed with that, the nature of the work requirement now really is more related to the functionality of whether or not an individual employee can perform their job and whether or not that performance is required by the nature of the work.
Okay, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Let me give you another 2 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. Our fallback or alternative argument is exactly as Judge Lee picked up on. If we had expert testimony, and no experts have gone through any Daubert or disclosure, we weren't supposed to give any expert testimony, but if our experts came in and said that employees were exposed to the most gravest and dangerous risks of all, under this ruling, it wouldn't matter. In other words, what we're setting up is OSHA is this new police force that you need a now, I guess even a heightened standard, we need an OSHA citation before we can come in and try to get FLSA compensation. Never has there been a link in any case, anywhere, between OSHA's police power or rulemaking power and FLSA compensation. They're two different agencies covering two sets of workers. And so it makes absolutely no sense. There's a discussion about cupola dust. I refer you to page 366 of the appendix. Cupola dust was spread all over by Zamboni-sized sweepers, and it was mixed all over the place. The dust that these workers have, as described in the affidavits, it was in their orifices, their ears, their nose, their underwear. They are covered in it. There's over 30 carcinogens identified in the MSDS sheets. At the very least, an expert should be able to come in and say, you are absolutely crazy if you don't wash this off your body. You are absolutely crazy if you don't do this. Now, they have their experts and their industrial hygienists. We have OSHA, NIOSH experts, too, all of them saying, you're crazy if you don't do this. We should have a right to present that to a jury.
And you submitted that testimony, didn't you, in the follow-up motion? Or the
in a follow-up, and the judge says, it doesn't matter if there's a conflict, because unless OSHA does something, you're out. And that's never been ruled upon before. And I think part of it was the judge had forgotten that he instructed people not to submit expert testimony because, as you see in his first thing, plaintiffs didn't submit any expert testimony, therefore they lose. When we pointed out to the judge, hey, judge, remember you told us not to do that? Then he said, oh, well, it doesn't matter, and it doesn't matter if it even conflicts. But one of the problems is, how do we even know that the expert evidence conflicted because we never even got to Daubert? Would their evidence have even gotten through Daubert? Would their expert evidence saying, you don't need to shower, would that have even gone through Daubert? Who knows? Who knows? And so for those reasons, at the very least, this has to be remanded. But if it is remanded, I would implore the court to give the trial court some guidance on how to apply the facts. Thank you.
Thanks much. Thanks to both counsel. This case will be taken under advisement.